Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. La Mesa police have identified the officer who fired a beanbag that struck protester Leslie Furcon in the head, seriously injuring the Lemon Grove grandmother on May 30th. Find out what video from body cam footage and other sources reveals about that incident on today's show. A new protest is planned on August 1st at the La Mesa police station, including planned civil disobedience. COVID-19 has impacted thousands of refugees and asylum seekers in San Diego County who have survived torture. Hear how the pandemic and lockdown are hurting these vulnerable people on today's show. As the nation mourns the death of Congressman John Lewis, an icon in the civil rights movement, we'll be replaying highlights of our interview with him during his visit to San Diego back in 2013, and his words on the importance of standing up for social justice are just as relevant today as they were then. The ACLU has won a temporary court injunction against federal troops targeting journalists and protest observers in Portland, Oregon, a decision with national implications, and we'll have details. A local family from Campo has suffered a horrific tragedy in an accident that killed two of their children and left several other family members injured, including a pregnant mother. Hear how you can help them on today's show. Allegations by multiple women accuse teachers at Christian Youth Theater, an El Cajon-based national organization, of sexual abuse of students as well as racism, and we'll have details. Our newsmaker interview today is with Dr. Raed Al-Nasser, a La Mesa physician who discusses the challenges of assessing impacts of COVID-19 on people of Middle Eastern origins here in San Diego's East County. We'll also have news about a federal bill that would eliminate protections against payday lenders charging exorbitant rates. Plus, we'll tell you about an East County Magazine investigation that has resulted in the county changing its grant program to provide relief for more small businesses and nonprofit organizations during the pandemic. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. The La Mesa Police Department has identified the officer who fired a beanbag that struck protester Leslie Furcon on the forehead during a chaotic protest outside the La Mesa police station on May 30th over police use of force and racial justice issues. The beanbag projectile seriously injured the Lemon Grove grandmother. Police also released two body camera videos of the incident, as well as a critical incident video and other information. Detective Eric Knudsen, a 12-year veteran of the La Mesa Police Force, fired the beanbag round from an elevated patio about 96 feet away. Knudsen was hailed back in 2018 as a local hero by the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce, which presented him with an award. Body cam footage makes clear that Furcon hurled an object toward police seconds before she was hit by the beanbag. Her own video showed her drinking from a can and then tossing it. One of the two body cameras includes footage and an officer's voice stating, "That was the guy who's throwing things, the guy who is down right now," referring to Furcon. A police timeline, police videos, and videos by media at the scene show that officers were under barrage by large rocks and other objects for several hours, with some striking and injuring officers just before Leslie Furcon was injured. Dispatch audio and photos indicate a fire was burning in the police parking lot, and City Hall had been set on fire at the time. An unlawful assembly had been declared at 5:09 p.m., and multiple orders to disperse had also been given. Furcon was standing near a Civic Center sign when she was hit by the beanbag round at 8:16 p.m. Video shows a barrage of objects, some striking officers, just before she was hit by a beanbag between her eyes. Protesters picked up Furcon about a minute after she was hit and carried her to a vehicle. She was hospitalized, put in an induced coma, and underwent surgery. She has lost vision in one eye, according to her attorney, Dante Pride, who contends that she was targeted for exercising free speech, including calling police murderers during the protest. Video live-streamed by Furcon herself showed her stating that she was entering a riot and calling for the police station to be burned down, though it appears the officer who fired the beanbag was not aware of that video and mistook Furcon for a man. Detective Knudsen is on paid administrative leave as the investigation continues. The district attorney's office will review the investigation when completed to determine if the officer should be charged with any crime. Now, La Mesa Police policy requires that beanbags, if used for crowd control, be aimed at the torso, never the head. However, the substantial distance and the fact that Furqan had moved forward as she hurled the can makes it unclear if the officer aimed at her torso or higher. At a press conference after her release from Sharp Grossbonne Hospital, Ms. Furqan stated, "I'm a law-abiding citizen, and I never came out here at night for this to be a part of my story." Chief Walt Vasquez issued a statement Thursday in which he says he continues to pray for Ms. Furqan and hopes she continues to heal and make a full recovery. He adds, "Rest assured that the men and women of the La Mesa Police Department are committed to providing quality and professional police service to our community. It is my hope that we will continue to heal the wounds, nurture an environment of open communications, and make La Mesa a safer place to live." Meanwhile, a new protest is planned at the police station on August 1st. That's a Saturday, at 3:30 p.m. On social media, the organizers are calling for civil disobedience to push for their demands to be met. The group is calling for the August 1st protest to be an adults-only event for reasons that are not clear. Police in the city have met some of the protesters' initial demands, including taking steps to form a Citizens Police Oversight Committee, eliminate use of chokeholds, and release body cam footage as well as names of officers involved in the Leslie Furqan beanbag shooting and an earlier stop of Amari Johnson, a young black man near a trolley station. Johnson was charged with assaulting an officer, but that charge was dropped after body cam footage failed to substantiate the officer's version of the event, which some have contended was racial profiling. An investigation continues while the officers involved remain on administrative leave, but neither has been fired, as protesters demand. The city's contract with the police union requires that investigations must be complete before any disciplinary action can be taken. Some protesters have also called for defunding certain police activities and instead investing in programs such as mental health and social services, though thus far the city has resisted that course of action. On the other hand, some city residents have also backed more funding for police in the wake of looting and fires that burned unchecked due to the civil unrest on that long night, May 30th through 31st. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
An estimated 35,000 torture survivors reside in San Diego County. Many are facing job loss without access to government help. Mental health issues such as PTSD are triggered by lockdown measures which remind them of house arrest in countries from which they fled. Many don't qualify for CARES Act benefits and are struggling financially. Some have gone without food for days, and for some recent arrivals, their asylum claims are in limbo. Only one torture treatment agency is accredited to serve this vulnerable population in our region, Survivors of Torture International. The nonprofit organization serves people from 90 different nations who fled state-sponsored or politically motivated torture. Last year, over 80% of their clients were asylum seekers. The group helps torture survivors find help for mental health and physical trauma to help them heal, as well as providing evaluations that may support asylum seekers' cases. Unlike refugees who can access public benefits, often asylum seekers cannot, says Katrina Pimental, community relations manager at Survivors of Torture. And they've been hard hit by the COVID-19 shutdowns. So, Survivors of Torture has taken many services virtual, checking to see if clients' basic needs are being met for food, transportation access, and housing, if they have masks or need translators to understand health orders, or if immigrants have suffered job losses. Some don't own cars, so have been unable to go to drive-through food banks. One person just had surgery when the lockdown began, had no access to transportation or food, and hadn't eaten in 3 days. Many of the people served by Survivors of Torture couldn't qualify for stimulus checks under the CARES Act, so survivors began delivering food, masks, and other cleaning supplies to meet basic needs. Pimental says, "With increased isolation comes increased mental health symptoms, like stress and anxiety and depression, and some of the clients even said, it reminds me of house arrest back in my home country." So the organization launched virtual individualized therapy and psychiatry programs in partnership with UCSD, and is looking into providing music therapy remotely. The organization is also providing therapy for children and families through schools, including through Cajon Valley School District in East County. Pimental says that refugees and asylum seekers need to form a sense of community here. She says, "We're making sure we're providing all of our core services, that no client falls through the gap, and then shifting our thinking and the tools we use to try to get even more creative, because we know COVID is a long journey." Despite the isolation and difficulties posed by the pandemic, Pimentel observes, "Our clients are resilient. Many have survived not only torture, but the ordeal of fleeing through many countries on their journey to America to protect themselves and their families." Pimentel says, "With treatment, with care, with specialized help, they flourish," and adds, "Our clients have hope. They rebuild their lives. They are and continue to be wonderful neighbors and community members and an essential piece of the fabric of this country." She says her clients understand their social responsibility during COVID-19. They are wearing masks and social distancing to protect others. Pimentel wants to see the 35,000 survivors of torture in San Diego County included in discussions of vulnerable populations worthy of support because they have unique needs. Some have come here with their families, but others are alone, and the survivors of torture organization is often their only safety net. COVID-19 has increased economic instability and isolation. Pimentel wants everyone hearing this report to know that refugees and asylum seekers who survived torture and now call San Diego home are, in her words, deserving of being included and uplifted. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jonathan Goetz.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Congressman John Lewis, famed civil rights leader, died July 17th of pancreatic cancer at age 80. The son of sharecroppers, Lewis drew inspiration from Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks to become a courageous champion in the civil rights movement for more than 60 years. Calling him the conscience of the Congress, where he served as a representative from Georgia for over 40 years, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi ordered the flag over our nation's capital flown at half-mast in respect. Lewis denounced violence and was arrested more than 40 times for peaceful protests against injustice. In 1965, TV newscasts nationwide showed a trooper fracturing his skull with a billy club in what became known as Bloody Sunday on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. The violence outraged the nation, leading to swift passage of the Voting Rights Act signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson. One of 10 children, Lewis shared in farm work after his parents earned enough money sharecropping on a white man's land to buy their own farm. His childhood home had no running water or electricity. He worked as a janitor to put himself through divinity school. Though his parents encouraged him to accept segregation as the way things were in the 40s and 50s, Lewis rejected that idea. He became one of the original 13 Freedom Riders, activists traveling in the South in 1961 to challenge segregation in transportation. He led lunch counter sit-ins to end segregation at diners and organized protests at many other venues. He was often beaten by thugs or by law enforcement and was once left lying in a pool of blood, and yet he kept on marching. He spoke at the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, alongside Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. He lived to see passage of the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights Movement, which empowered his own election to public office, and the first African-American man elected President of the United States. That president, Barack Obama, presented Congressman Lewis with the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2011, the highest honor bestowed on an American civilian. His motto became "Getting into Good Trouble," the title of a documentary film on his life. He also authored a series of graphic novels or comic books on the civil rights movement to inspire young people to learn about history and become active in the fight against injustice everywhere. At times, Congressman Lewis's actions changed hearts and minds. A Ku Klux Klan leader who once beat Lewis came to his congressional office years later at age 70 to apologize and set a better example for his own son. Lewis credited this transformation to the way of peace, the way of love, CNN reported. And he added, "We must never, ever hate. The way of love is a better way." On another occasion during a Bloody Sunday commemorative march in Selma, the city's segregationist mayor from 1965, who was still in power, presented Lewis with a key to the city in 1998. Back then, I called him an outside rabble-rouser, Mayor Smitherman said. Today, I call him one of the most courageous people I ever met. In the wake of Confederate monuments being toppled recently across the nation this summer, some posters on social media have suggested erecting replacement statues to honor the legacy of John Lewis for breaking down barriers to racial equality, while others have called for passage of a new Voting Rights Act pending in Congress. After the brutal killing of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minnesota in May sparked a new wave of protests across the nation, Lewis told CBS This Morning in June that the Black Lives Matter movement feels different because, he said, it's more massive and all-inclusive than many other protests for racial equality. Shortly before his death, Lewis predicted there will be no turning back. Known for his powerful oratory skills in the House, he spoke against not only racial injustice, but injustice for all. After a mass murder at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, he led a sit-in on the House floor calling for national gun control, though that effort was unsuccessful. Never afraid of controversy, he refused to attend the inauguration of President Donald Trump, blaming Russian interference in the election. Trump denigrated Lewis in a Twitter post in response, stating that he should spend more time fixing conditions in a district the president called crime-infested. Trump, astoundingly, derided the leader who galvanized passage of the Voting Rights Act as, quote, all talk, 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 no action or results, sad. But other political leaders on both sides of the aisle have praised Lewis profusely. Every year, Congressman Lewis returned to Selma for an anniversary march on that bridge, joined by civil rights leaders and presidents in both parties, including George W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, and Barack Obama. Now, some want to rename the Edmund Pettus Bridge, titled after a segregationist, and instead call it the John Lewis Bridge to honor the man who fought tirelessly against segregation. Former President George W. Bush, a Republican, praised Lewis as a man who, quote, answered brutal violence with courageous hope, and throughout his career as a civil rights leader and public servant, he worked to make our country a more perfect union. America can best honor John's memory by continuing his journey toward liberty and justice for all, Bush said. San Diego Congresswoman Susan Davis says Congressman Lewis had a special relationship with many of our local high school students who visited the Capitol, where he was always willing to share his inspiring story. She says, what a loss to all we felt. John Lewis's courage and greatness as he urged us to make good trouble. She posted on Facebook, I am both profoundly saddened and grateful to have spent work days and pilgrimages with him as he led us through the fight for civil rights for all. Former Vice President Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential nominee, issued this statement. I know of no man with more courage than John Lewis. He was a giant walking among us. When I saw him, I couldn't help but think one thing. I haven't done enough. May his life and legacy inspire every one of us to strive for justice, equality, and what is right, Biden concluded. During a 2013 visit to Comic-Con in San Diego to promote March, his graphic novel about his own life, Lewis spoke with East County Magazine reporters Nadine and Tom Abbott in a taped interview. That interview took place shortly after the murder of Trayvon Martin, an unarmed teen killed by a stand-your-ground, armed white man in Florida that sparked national protests. And now, we're going to replay that brief interview since his words back then are still applicable to the civil unrest and racial justice issues that America is grappling with today.
Chris, how excited are you that now this is moved into, the history is moved into a graphic novel?
Well, I'm very excited. I think this is another way, another method of reaching people, telling the story, making it come alive, especially for young people and for people not so young, to remember this part of our history. It's not that many years ago. During the past 50 or 60 years.
My other question is, given recent events and given how the FBI actually tracked Martin Luther King, how concerned are you with NSA actually tracking Americans?
Well, I'm concerned. I'm deeply concerned when there's a possibility of violating the privacy of people, eavesdropping on our citizens. We saw it during the 50s, during the 60s. When people spied on the civil rights movement and made it almost impossible for people to do their own work in a peaceful and nonviolent way.
Congressman, were you initially sold on the idea of telling your story in graphic novel format?
Well, one of my staff person who had worked in my campaign came to me and said, Congressman, let's do a comic book. Mm-hmm. And I said, a comic book? Mm-hmm. And he didn't give up. But he reminded me that in 1957, an organization called the Fellowship of Reconciliation did a little book, a comic book, mm-hmm. only about 14 pages, and maybe 14 pages or less, but it was the Montgomery story during the Montgomery bus boycott. It was Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story, and reminded me that a group of young people read the book, and they got involved in a sit-in in Greensboro, North Carolina, mm-hmm. on February the 1st, 1960.
What are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, I hope that hundreds and thousands of young people all across America and around the world would pick up this book and be inspired to engage in nonviolent direct action. When they see something that is not right, something that is unjust, that they would be moved to protest. Mm-hmm. That's what we did during the 60s. Mm-hmm. So it tells the story of my growing up as a poor child in rural Alabama during the 40s and the 50s. Listen to the words of Martin Luther King Jr., following the drama of Rosa Parks, mm-hmm. and getting arrested 40 times, and getting thrown in jail and beaten.
Are you happy with how the book turned out?
I'm very happy, very, very pleased. Our publisher, Top Chef, has done an unbelievable job. And my co-writer, Andrew Aiden, and Nate Powell, the graphic artist, mm-hmm. they're unbelievable. And the three of us have worked together. Mm-hmm. There's three guys from the South, mm-hmm. Two whites and one African American, came together and to tell a story.
One last question. Given the murder of Trayvon Martin recently and the murder of Emmett Till in the 50s, is there a connection with all of that, with what we're having right now with civil rights?
Well, I spoke to someone yesterday with a group of my colleagues in the Congress, with someone from the Department of Justice, and I said nothing, not one thing have moved me more since the murder of Emmett Till on August the 28th, 1955. I was 15 years old when that happened. And there's a lot of pain in America today, a tremendous amount of hurt and pain on the part of all citizens. It doesn't matter whether we're black or white, Latino or Asian American or Native American. People are hurting. And this is touching the very souls of a lot of people. And said that we're not there yet. We made a lot of progress, but we're not there yet. So there's still work to be done.
Congressman, the President said yesterday that the younger generation is doing better overall in terms of questions of race. Yourself working with younger activists, has that been your takeaway as well?
Well, the young people are doing much better. Many of the young people cannot even conceive of the whole question of race. Young people who are growing up together, studying together, they cannot see blacks, a white, a Latino, or Asian American, a Native American. They've never seen those signs that said white waiting, a colored waiting, a colored only, a white only. The only places they would see those signs would be in a book, on a video, or in a museum. And we got to move all American toward that place where we can lay down the burden of race and create one America, one multiracial democratic society.
This is Jonathan Getz with an update from Portland by Jake Johnson of Common Dreams. The American Civil Liberties Union Foundation of Oregon sued the Trump administration late Friday over its deployment of federal agents to Portland, where unidentified officials from the Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Marshals Service have been detaining Black Lives Matter protesters without explanation and using indiscriminate force to crush demonstrations. Kelly Seinman, interim legal director with the ACLU of Oregon, said in a statement, "This is a fight to save our democracy." It continues, "Under the direction of the Trump administration, federal agents are terrorizing the community, risking lives, and brutally attacking protesters demonstrating against police brutality. This is police escalation on top of police escalation. According to Simon, quote, these federal agents must be stopped and removed from our city. She continued, we will continue to bring the full firepower of the ACLU to bear until this lawless policing ends. The lawsuit against DHS and the U.S. Marshals Service, filed on behalf of legal observers and journalists who were recently assaulted by federal agents in Portland, aims to, quote, block federal law enforcement from dispersing, arresting, threatening to arrest, or using physical force against journalists or legal observers. One of the plaintiffs, freelance photographer Matthew Lewis Rowland, was shot in the back 10 times with impact munitions during a recent demonstration. The ACLU said the suit is, quote, one of many. It plans to file against the Trump administration over its deployment of federal agents to Portland, against the wishes of state and local political leaders who have demanded the withdrawal of all federal law enforcement. Federal officials have reportedly been patrolling Portland in unmarked vehicles and arresting demonstrators since at least July 14th. Vera Eidelman, staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, said, what is happening in Portland is an unconstitutional nightmare. Eidelman adds, this is not law and order. This is lawlessness. The ACLU will not let the government respond to protests against police brutality with still more brutality. We will continue to hold law enforcement at all levels of government accountable, just as we have nationwide.
This is Miriam Raftery. Now, after Jonathan Goetz recorded that news item, we received a late-breaking report that a federal judge has issued a 14-day order on Thursday temporarily barring federal officers from using force, threats, and dispersal orders against journalists or legal observers documenting the daily demonstrations in downtown Portland. U.S. District Judge Michael Simon quoted case law from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals saying, when wrongdoing is underway, officials have great incentive to blindfold the eyes of the Fourth Estate. The free press is the guardian of the public interest, and the judiciary is the guardian of the press, he said. The judge rejected the government's arguments that federal officers could not protect the press amid sometimes violent clashes, and the judge made clear that any willful violation of his order by a federal supervisor or commander will result in that officer losing qualified immunity protections, opening the door for federal officers to be held accountable in civil lawsuits for use of excessive force.
A Campo family has suffered a tragic accident in New Mexico while traveling home from a visit to Texas. Brad and Crystal Sparks, along with their six children, were in a rollover crash when their SUV went off the road on a remote, dark highway on July 12th. Two of their children were killed and other family members suffered injuries. The vehicle had rolled out of sight of passing motorists. Fortunately, Brad Sparks, who works for a fire protection company in Poway, was able to use voice commands to access his Apple Watch and call 911 for help. Some of the children were able to unbuckle their seatbelts and free themselves from the wreckage. But Brad and Crystal, who was 7 months pregnant, were suspended upside down for over an hour. By the time help arrived, including two Life Flight helicopters and six ambulances, it was too late to save the couple's daughter, 12-year-old Bailey, and their 10-year-old son, Landon. Brad was rescued using Jaws of Life before being taken with the four surviving children to two different hospitals. Crystal was also flown to a hospital. Her injuries include a punctured lung, broken ribs, broken shoulder, and shattered foot, but fortunately her unborn baby survived. Brad suffered a fractured face and broken knee. He and the surviving four children are now out of the hospital, though Crystal remains hospitalized as of our show taping deadline. A GoFundMe page, set up by a friend at Foothills Christian Church, has raised over $187,000 so far. Donations are needed to help with medical costs, funeral expenses, counseling, vehicle replacement, daily living expenses, and necessities for the baby due to be born in October. You can donate at the Sparks Family Fundraiser on GoFundMe. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, Get trained to be a citizen journalist and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Christian Youth Theater, or CYT, a national junior theater organization based in El Cajon, is now in the spotlight over allegations by former students of sexual abuse and racism dating back decades. The organization, established 40 years ago in El Cajon, formerly managed the East County Performing Arts Center, held summer camps and classes across our region, and has performed at many local venues ranging from public schools to the amphitheater atop Mount Helix. Attorney Jessica Pride is representing two women who say they were molested and harassed by teachers at CYT. She told NBC News that there are multiple perpetrators and many more victims. In one case, the abuse started in 2006 and didn't end until 2008, she says. NBC reports that some former students have reported abuse as far back as the 1980s, both on and off CYT's East County campuses. Pride says instructors reportedly commented to female students about their physical development, appearance, and, quote, how they'd like them to wear certain panties, unquote. 10 News reports that more than 10 additional victims came forward with complaints after a student posted allegations of sexual abuse at CYT on Facebook. Now, none of the complaints made public so far are against any current instructors. Pride has accused CYT of covering up abuse for years. CYT leader Janie Russell Cox posted on Facebook, "We are deeply saddened to learn about the statements that have recently been made on social media involving former CYT students, and we want you to know that we take these allegations very seriously." Cox says CYT is working with authorities, outside consultants, staff, and the board of directors since these allegations were brought to its attention. San Diego Police Department has confirmed to local media that its sex crimes unit is investigating the allegations as well. Besides sexual misconduct, several former students have accused CYT of allowing bullying, discrimination against LGBTQ youths, and racial bias, according to multiple local media reports. Charnette Beatty is a former CYT student and actress who went on to perform in Broadway plays, including Hamilton. In a video statement, she indicated she was never given a leading role, even roles written for black women, which were given to whites instead. "I didn't have money and I wasn't a big CYT rich family," she said, adding, "I was never celebrated or recognized until I found success outside of CYT and outside of the color of my skin." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. Dr. Riad Al-Nasser is a pulmonologist at Sharp Grossmont Hospital and the president of the National Arab American Medical Association, San Diego chapter. East County Magazine journalist Brianna Gomez sat down for an interview with Dr. Nasser at the end of June on the impacts of COVID-19 on the Arab American community locally and the challenges in assessing those impacts.
You've advocated recently for more testing and more visibility with Middle Eastern communities pertaining to COVID-19. What has been your experience in your personal practice or at Sharp in terms of the influx of possible COVID cases in the Middle Eastern community?
Okay. When the COVID-19 hit the country and our city and county in particular, I was greatly disturbed by a parallel observation. COVID-19 is affecting patients of color and minorities, particularly African-American and Latinos across the country in a disproportionate manner. Though through my work at the ICU of Sharp Grossmont Hospital, I also witnessed a similar observation at the outset of the pandemic. At this hospital, I observed also the disproportionate number of COVID-19 cases from the Arabic and the Middle Eastern community, especially the community of El Cajon. And the similar observation assassination also were occurred by my colleagues. And we had quite concern about this observation when we saw that. We had expressed that identification of Middle Eastern is not accurate in medical records as well as in the San Diego County statistics. So San Diego County published a breakdown of COVID-19 cases according to race and ethnicity, mirroring the U.S. census. And often, a lot of times, in the population from Arabic or Middle Eastern community, either are listed as white, Caucasian, or even listed as unknown or others. And when I review the percentage of unknown cases of COVID-19 in San Diego County, I see there is about 20 to 20% of the cases listed as unknown. And that's kind of concerning. I'm not sure who are these group of people or groups of people, and whether the Middle Eastern community is a big proportion of this unknown. And especially, you know, the patients in our community often list, they don't even list their ethnicity or race. And sometimes to the admitting office, and based on maybe language, they kind of put other or unknown. So it's very difficult to assess, you know, what is the true number. But just from observation, you know, bedside observation, I think, you know, there is a considerable number of our community affected by COVID-19, and probably disproportionate, because we have a community that works in essential jobs, and I don't think they can practice the best social distancing measures to medicate the risk of catching the COVID-19. Also, you know, I know for sure, because I take care of my patients, and a big proportion of my patients actually Middle Eastern and Arabic patients. I know that there are multiple, you know, health conditions affecting this population disproportionately, like diabetes, hypertension, and also chronic lung disease, and particularly related to smoking. And smoking is a very common problem in the Middle Eastern and Arabic population, particularly among men. So these kind of observation made me think that I think we have a problem there, and that should be addressed in a better way. And unfortunately, so far, the identification is not allowing the Arabic and other Middle Eastern communities to identify themselves as a special category, a very obvious category. Often, you know, patients have to pick either Caucasian or other, and the other, often they don't list exactly what ethnicity they are.
Absolutely. So, okay, you as a doctor, a Middle Eastern doctor, you were able to recognize these patients coming in that were Middle Eastern. You mentioned that some of them were being marked as Caucasian during the intake. What are some of the problems, other than the fact that these communities aren't having equal access to the same resources? What are some of the other problems with people of Middle Eastern and Arab communities being listed as Caucasian? How does that affect Caucasian people, and how does that affect their health outcomes also by having other groups who are kind of mixed up into that field, who have other morbidity, comorbidity factors that maybe your typical Caucasian American would not have?
Well, I don't think, you know, that's going to affect the Caucasian community in particular, because the you know, the number of the Middle Eastern community would probably somehow add into the statistic of the Caucasian. And maybe, you know, somehow this would affect actually the other minorities, in a sense, like, you know, actually we are even given less weight to the other minorities, like the Latino and African American, in terms of the impact of the disease on these communities. So it's the pie. It's like you have a pie, and you kind of probably, you know, shifting some of these patients from other minorities to Caucasian, and that might, you know, sound like the Caucasian have their share of, you know, the impact, when it's truly, I think they might have less In fact, based on some of their numbers, are actually related to probably different ethnic groups. You know, it affects actually the Arabic and Middle Eastern community a big deal because they are unknown. They are not counted. And when it comes to allocating healthcare services and resources, they are probably they are not going to get the right share when they suffer from this disease as well as other health-related problems, and somehow they are not getting their share of the allocation of resources. So, you know, accurate data is important, and if we don't have the accurate data, we cannot really move in the right direction. Yeah, so that's why we think, you know, we should have a special category and clear category for, you know, Middle Eastern people or Arabic people, or, you know, we would be more representative of this community. And I'm just not talking about my community. I'm talking also about other smaller minorities and communities. I think they should have the right of accurate representation in our data.
Yeah, absolutely. I think accurate data is extremely important, especially with regard to the medical field. So you noticed that this was a dilemma that both you and you said your colleagues as well tended to kind of take note of, an influx of Middle Eastern patients during the rise of COVID-19. Were you able, you or any of your colleagues, was anybody able to speak with a Sharp healthcare system from an administrative perspective to try to advocate for better intake forms or better identifying factors for these communities? Has there been any work with that from within?
Well, to be honest with you, that was very difficult to do because, again, you know, the forms that we have, you know, does not, you know, reflect Middle Eastern or maybe you can do a little bit of work to, from the name or second language, but someone had to do that extra work. You know, we probably need to convince the San Diego County to have that category added because, you know, that will be implemented across hospitals in San Diego.
And this is an issue for our assembly people then to address on a statewide or countywide scale?
I think, you know, it should be more of a countywide at least and also probably a statewide. You know, I'm sure there are also, you know, this issue affects our communities in counties like Orange County, maybe Los Angeles County, Riverside. If you look at the Southern California in general, there are pockets of Arabic and Middle Eastern communities, not only in San Diego.
You mentioned so linguistics is obviously an identifying factor. When I did reach out to the County Department of Health Services, I think that you saw the response that I received from them saying that this is the only data we have available and they'll forward my request, but that they don't expect to have any additional data provided. One of the problems, too, that I encountered also was with linguistic identifying factors, it doesn't account for people who are originally from those Middle Eastern countries but grew up outside of those countries and have another native language. So if you're an Arab American who was born here and your first language and only language is English, that also kind of fails to consider those individuals. But as you mentioned, kind of linguistics is a starting point but not an ending point for that. There's another dilemma faced with the term Middle Eastern because some people have considered themselves to be Middle Eastern, people from the Indian subcontinent, for example, people from parts of North Africa, people in Iran, Afghanistan, and the ethnic minorities there, accordingly, that aren't necessarily Arab but have been Arabized. What do you consider to be Middle Eastern, and what's the best way to account for all Middle Eastern people, not just Arab Americans, for example, or the confined Middle East that we've been taught?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, also a complex issue. But in general, you know, my understanding that a category was supposed to be on the census, this 2020 census, and this was suggested, you know, lobbied by different Arab American and other Middle Eastern organizations across the nation. And during the past administration, I think there was a green light to go ahead and do the and had a category called Middle Eastern North African or MENA category, which I think it's reasonably representative, you know, for a good portion of that part of the world. You know, that includes, you know, the whole Middle East, Arab world, North Africa, and also like countries like Iran, Armenia, Afghanistan. As you know, a population, we have a similar culture, and that includes different, you know, even smaller ethnicities, Kurdish, Assyrian, yeah, even like in North Africa, the Amazigh, Berber. So that was a reasonably representative. It's not exactly, you know, one group of people, but it kind of like gives a good representation. And, you know, I would take analogy is like the Asian representation where you have the Chinese, the Japanese, the Vietnamese. Yeah, but at least, you know, you have some sort of category that kind of include all these nationalities. To me, in my opinion, that was a reasonably good way to represent our community. But unfortunately, that didn't go through for, you know, political reason, I think. And the census now does not have that category, and still we are stuck with the unknown, and then you have to write in if you think that you have a different category, which is not exactly the same. It doesn't add the same weight as if you have a certain defined category.
A recognized category. What can we do as citizens and community members to advocate for that category? Is there certain steps that you think that we should take in order to have that in terms of like a government recognized category?
We have advocated this on our media, and there are different organizations in the local community, you know, share the same concern, and you know, also they you know, ask you know, the population to identify themselves for any in the census by writing like Arab American, Middle Eastern, or Syrian, Iraqi, or whatever you think you want to write. Because that at least give some identification. Yeah, I'm not sure if everyone is on board with this. Some of our community are skeptical, might feel maybe they could get targeted for some reason or another by identifying. They don't like to just be recognized, you know, sometimes, you know, out of fear, probably.
Sure.
You know, maybe profiling or something, they kind of feel like, you know, it's better just to mention Caucasian. And again, you know, there is a lot of debate about this, but in general, most organizations in the Arabic and Middle Eastern communities advocate for adding a separate category. And for the time, at least if you write in under the category of other, at least we have some identification.
Absolutely. So there is a fear of self-identifying then as Middle Eastern because of the political climate currently.
I think so. I think, you know, then that's probably a concern for some of the community members.
That's definitely an interesting statement because other communities like Hispanic, Latino are really vying to be recognized and have been recognized to an extent, but they don't necessarily face that same fear of self-identifying. My last question, there's been kind of certain correlations made between low-income populations and rises in COVID-19 because of things like comorbidity factors in those communities, a lack of access to healthcare, shared housing, large families kind of in one home, and essential workers. Other than the fact that many Middle Eastern people may be essential workers, Middle Eastern Americans don't tend to face the same low-income crisis as other minorities. And I know we discussed this previously a little bit, but in terms of statistically, Arab Americans, Iranian Americans, Indian Americans have enjoyed a lot of financial success and education, higher education in the United States. Why do you think that they are also being disproportionately affected? Do you feel that it could be a genetic issue in that case? Because many of these people don't have the same lack of access to healthcare, for example, or lack of education that other minorities are facing.
Well, there are many factors. One factor, it could be genetic, but I usually don't give much weight to this because, you know, a lot of these issues are also across the board of other minorities, like African-American and also Latino. Particularly with the Arab American community is also not a homogeneous community. And you might have the higher income and higher socioeconomic segment, but they don't live in one area. They are usually dispersed in the county and the state. But if you look at the community of El Cajon particularly, there is more of the newcomers. And also there are the refugees that they came from Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan and Sudan. So you have a group of newcomers where they don't enjoy the privilege of the earlier immigrants. They tend to be low income. They tend to have more crowded housing, big proportion of them, and they're dependent on state assistance program. So, you know, that kind of group is probably share the most of impact of any health-related problems. Talking about COVID-19, this is the basically the highest risk group of population. So most of these, they have very basic jobs, essential jobs like grocery, gas station workers, maybe some small restaurants workers, cleaning services, etc. They are in a high-risk category in terms of catching COVID-19 or other, you know, respiratory illnesses or communicable disease. So this group of people, the one I am kind of concerned about, because they are underrepresented, they are underrecognized. They need the help the most. As you said, you know, in general, all over the country, Arab American and other Middle Eastern communities enjoyed a higher standard of living compared to other ethnic groups, and they are, you know, usually well-to-do. But, you know, we are not talking about this particular group in particular. Now, there are probably issues with certain behaviors, probably, you know, which is could be cultural. We like to congregate. We like to get with our extended family more than probably other communities. We tend to have larger size parties where we have all the cousins and the cousins of the cousins and big family gatherings. So this kind of social behavior might contribute to a spread of this disease, which we know for sure that it is part of the, you know, the problem. But, you know, I think in our community was aware of this, and maybe we had made some education and we made a good reach out to the community to curb this behavior for the time being. People, they might go back to their roots, and they might, at the moment that you hear that, you know, there's opening of the economy and things might go back to the same way that we practice. And then it's probably, you know, just going to have an impact on a second wave of the disease or another surge. So we still have to be cautious. We still have to be thinking about this. It is not over yet. It's going to take time. And the fight against COVID is going to be maybe a year or more, or even until we have an efficient, effective vaccine and also probably more efficient treatment options. So that particular part, the cultural part, it is one of the factors. Now, one thing, as probably I mentioned earlier, that smoking and smoking-related disorder probably is also a contributing factor. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. in people from the Middle East and our countries are a heavy smoker, particularly men. It is not really something to be proud of, but, you know, I like my country, Jordan, scored the top ranking number of smokers in the whole world. According to show. So it's not something that we should be proud of. And even the people who come to the United States or, you know, Europe, they carry these habits with them, and it's harder and harder to quit smoking. So smoking, yeah, I think, and smoking-related disorder that affects patients is a major risk factor for getting extremely sick with COVID-19 and having higher chances of long-term disability or death even.
Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Good job.
My pleasure.
That's it. Thank you for being a strong advocate for our community.
An East County Magazine investigation has resulted in major changes to the County of San Diego's stimulus program, making more small businesses and nonprofits eligible as a result. On July 7th, the county announced its plan to use $17 million in CARES Act funding to provide grants to help local small businesses, restaurants, and nonprofits that suffered financial losses due to COVID-19. But East County Magazine's special report exposed that documents required in the application would prevent most businesses in the unincorporated areas of the county from applying, as well as nonprofits that are volunteer-run. The application originally required all applicants to have a business license, but the county no longer issues those to businesses in the unincorporated areas, so only businesses with a license in a city could apply. The application also required documents to prove employment and payroll deductions, which nonprofits that rely on volunteers only don't have. Yet those nonprofits have lost significant revenues due to being unable to host fundraising events and donations down due to the pandemic, limiting their ability to fund needed programs and services. After East County Magazine brought these flaws to the attention of Supervisor Diane Jacob, the county changed its rules. And we're pleased to announce that a business license is no longer required of businesses in unincorporated areas. Proof of employees is also not required for all volunteer nonprofits now. Businesses and nonprofits are urged to apply early for the county grants. Applications will be accepted through October 16th, but only if funds are still available. For-profit and nonprofit businesses can apply for grant money if they can show losses and costs are a direct result of the pandemic. To qualify, they must have 100 or fewer employees, headquarters in San Diego County, at least 1 year of operating history as of February 14th, documentation of financial hardship because of COVID-19, and you can find more information as well as the application by visiting the stimulus website. That's sandiegocounty.gov/stimulus-grant. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
The Trump administration released a proposal this week that would make it easier for banks and payday lenders to charge sky-high interest rates despite California laws against predatory lending. The Office of the Comptroller of Currency wants to overturn the true lender doctrine and allow payday lenders to evade state interest rate caps by listing a bank as the lender. Lauren Saunders with the National Consumer Law Center says this will bring back rent-a-bank schemes and allow companies such as OpLoans and LoanMart to charge 100% or even 200% in interest.
It's outrageous at this time of economic crisis that the Trump administration, in action after action, is siding with predatory lenders charging outrageous interest rates that just push people into debt and make it harder and harder for them to feed their families.
The Fed say the change is necessary to help banks sell their loans and manage liquidity and risk. This is the latest move by the administration that favors payday lenders. Recently, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau repealed rules that required payday lenders to make sure borrowers can afford to repay loans. And the FDIC repealed its guidance to banks limiting interest rates on small dollar loans to 36% or less. Saunders says last year, California tightened up some loopholes to forbid interest rates of more than 100% on loans up to $10,000.
In reaction, three large payday lenders announced that they were going to ignore California law and team up with banks to avoid the law because banks aren't subject to state interest rate limits. They haven't done that yet, but this proposed rule would make it easier.
The public comment period on the proposed rule is open at regulations.gov until September 3rd. The final rule, which comes out this fall, is likely to draw a legal challenge from consumer groups. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.